Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast, the podcast that is dedicated towards bridging the divide between the police and the communities that they serve. So for today, we got a little something a little bit different for you. We're going to be speaking with John Jennings of True Crime Excess Podcast. Once again, for all you true crime enthusiasts, this episode is going to be right up your alley. So we're going to get into it just a little bit. Also, I just want to remind you all to rate, subscribe, and share these episodes. Very important to get this word out and to keep on doing what we're doing. I appreciate all the love and all of the support that I've gotten so far. Thank you so much. So on your part, just keep up the good work. Remember that you can support the podcast through Cash App, PayPal, and Venmo. Go over to the Patreon page, Captain Hunter's Podcast on Patreon, and there you can support the podcast as well. Also remember that we started putting more videos up on YouTube, Captain Hunter's Podcast on videos. Got a number of episodes that are going to be coming up of both the audio format as well as the YouTube video format. So make sure that you're checking YouTube page as well for more content. Make sure that you follow me on Instagram, CPTL Hunter, Twitter, CPTL Hunter, Facebook, Captain Hunter's Podcast. So, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, let's get into the episode with our special guest for today, John Jennings of True Crime Podcast. What you can do is you can go over to True Crime Excess, truecrimeexcess.com. True Crime Excess is a true crime podcast about the aftermath of a serial killer's suicide and stories as they arise in an investigation into where his potential victims' remains may be found. They also have a merchandise page you can go over there for t-shirts, and a number of other items. So if true crime is your thing, make sure that you check out True Crime Excess Podcast, available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and wherever podcasts are available. And without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here is the interview with John Jennings of True Crime Excess Podcast. And once again, we started having a great conversation, so we're going to kind of pick it up right there in the middle of the conversation.
So, I'm glad to talk to you. You're exactly the type of person I was actually looking for, by the way. I was listening to some of your other podcasts the last few days.
Oh, I appreciate it.
And it's always interesting to see someone, and I could be wrong on this, but it seems to me that you like to sort of straddle the middle of the road. That's something I do, where I like to look at both perspectives and sort of, balance out what's really going on with the situation. And that's actually how I ended up podcasting. Was I looked at both extremes, and I was like, "Why is no one in the middle here?"
Yeah. So that's exactly what I try to do. I just try to call balls and strikes, and just try to analyze the situation, and try to give both perspectives. Now, I've been reading that may not be the best approach. People want you to take one side hard right or hard left or whatever. But I'm going to stick with what I'm doing and really just try to get each other's side. It's not always, the police aren't always right and the public isn't always right. So there's some, and I'm trying to branch out into some other things too. I'm really trying to talk to a lot of the public and in particularly the Black community, but not solely the Black community. And just try to get them to see that, there's some things that we need to be doing, right? And tomorrow I'm going to release an episode about watching your credit. I have a credit specialist come on. So there's a lot of stuff that we should be doing. And I think that, we're missing out on and lacking in. And so that's just my spiel, my stick. And hopefully I can carve out a niche here and really do something with it,
Yeah, and I think you will. And I actually admire you for taking that perspective, because in this day and age, I think it's easier to either take, the shorter point of view and say something that's sort of fantastic or controversial and get a short amount of attention, or, we've got a lot of, I don't want to call it successful, but there's a lot of people that get huge audiences based on ongoing shtick, where they basically made themselves into a caricature and everything they do is an extreme, very polarizing. And I'm a very even keeled person overall. I have my moments. I'm sure my partner and my kid might say, that's not always the case. Like that one time you were cooking but I like the patient approach, and that's the feel I got from you, was that you also take a fairly patient approach to things to see how they're gonna sort themselves out and how you can help.
So yeah. I like that. Yeah. Yeah, well, I appreciate that you're saying that, and I appreciate that you noticed that. So hopefully others will notice it as well. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, with what we're doing now, I had to coordinate a team of four or five people, and I sort of ended up becoming, I don't know if you're familiar with Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, but I became the Dr. Watson of the group and having to report like everything that had been sort of uncovered. And Meg is one of the people on my team. She's a more of a Sherlock Holmes person. Like, she's very temperamental and brilliant, like one of the most brilliant minds I've ever met. But she was going to, I think her plan was just to sort of write everything down, hand it to me and say, you know, turn it into the FBI and be done with it. And I didn't want to take that approach because when we're covering a case right now that's a serial killer, they consider the case to be closed. And I was like, well, it's been covered here and there and in some different forms, but I don't think anyone's picked up on what they missed. And I didn't want to just say to the FBI either, like, you guys did a bad job, because that wasn't true. The truth was, they didn't know what they were, they didn't know what they were dealing with. And they dealt with it in the best way possible. But anyways, I was just sort of going along with what we were talking about patience wise. That's where I fall. I sort of report everything after the fact.
Yeah. That's probably the best way. We've been talking about some good stuff so far. And before we go on, I just want to thank you for coming on the Captain Hunters podcast. I'm speaking with John Jennings of True Crimes XS. So thank you so much for being on the podcast.
And thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
It's really my pleasure. So just tell us about yourself and how you got into podcasting and true crime.
Well, so the podcasting part came way after the fact. In fact, most of what I'm using for the current podcast is actually a book. Like, I wrote it out over the last 5 or 6 years. I've written out the bulk of it coming in the last two because of the addition of some of the team members. Myself, I've always been in operations in different capacities. Like, I've always worked as, like, for a long time, I had a federal government job, and I had a job in an industry that's sort of gone now. That was the plastics recycling industry. And I, you know, early on, I had internships with big companies and think tanks and things like that. What drove me to true crime itself wasn't actually, like, when I was a kid, my mom was obsessed with the Jeffrey McDonald case in the Carolinas. He was a physician and then a soldier, an officer in the U.S. Army, who's, you know, entire family was killed either by him or someone else. And I got to see sort of firsthand the way that she supported him for a while. And I would have to ask her to know what her current opinion is, but, you know, she had very, very strong polarizing opinions about his prosecution and the way everything went down in the span of time there. And I shied away from it. I didn't really get into the same way she did into true crime. But later on, I got into mysterious disappearances. And my dad was a big fan of different outdoor magazines. He was, you know, a hunter and a fisherman. And so always, when I was growing up, there were always these outdoor life magazines and outdoor magazines laying around. And I would read them. And for the most part, I discovered along the way, I could look at most cases and go, oh, I know what happened there. And I don't mean that like psychic or anything, but there's a sort of a logical progression. Like, you know, this guy vanishes and like there was trouble financially and trouble at home. And like, more than likely he went out into the woods and he didn't want to be found again. What happened after that, I don't really know, but I know that like, he could be a suicide. He started a new life, but it's unlikely that that's foul play or that that's like a lost or injured person. And I got obsessed with a few cases back in the 90s. And those were cases where people walked out onto the mountainside or walked out to a campsite and they were never found and their stuff was never found. And like a car would be found in a parking lot. So for years, I sort of collected clippings and articles about that. And I was just sort of, you know, reading over them, wondering what happened to these people. And I was a Boy Scout growing up and I spent a lot of time in the woods. And like, I feel like I'm a pretty accomplished like hiker and camper. And some of these people looked like me and like they did things like me. And whether they were male or female or like whatever, when they mysteriously vanished, it was really one of those things that I would keep coming back to over the years. And I would wonder, like, has there been an update? Has anyone found anything? And there were a few of them where, you know, they wrapped up in the way that I sort of thought they would. And then from 1997 to about 2016, there have been 300 of them that I just look at them and I go, I wonder where that person is. And like one of the first cases really that really bothered me, there was a Wyoming case, Amy Bechtel. And then within a year or two, there was a Washington State case of this guy named Joe Wood. And Joe Wood and Amy Bechtel were the two that, like, I have the most, like, clippings and articles related to them. And with Amy Bechtel, you know, it clearly wasn't a suicide. She was making plans that day. She had plans that she didn't meet later that day. She just went for a jog. She was actually checking out a run for part of an upcoming run, this event that she was doing, which she was very active in the local community. And then she was just gone. And years later, they found a watch that might have been hers, but nothing else. With Joe Wood, he was actually from New York. And he had gone to a conference in the Seattle area. And he decided he was going to spend a few hours on Mount Rainier birdwatching. And his case was one of the more interesting cases to me because he was one of the first young, like, he was a little older than me, but like young, he was into editing and writing and a lot of the things that I did as hobbies. He was also an Eagle Scout and he happened to be a young African-American professional in 1999. And it was interesting how they covered those cases back then to me, because what happened with him was on July 8th, he goes out into the woods and he doesn't come back, but people don't realize he didn't come back for several days. So on July 15th and 16th, it started to become known in his circle that he's missing appointments and that's not like him at all. And they mount a search effort. It's actually a very extensive search effort. And for 1999, it was a record year on Mount Rainier as far as the amount of money they spent looking for people. Well, what was so interesting about Joe Wood's case is it had this brief pop where it was going to become a national news item because he was an editor in New York and he had gone to this, like, this place far away. It was like ramping up to where they were really going to cover his case. And then John F. Kennedy Jr. went missing in his plane.
Right.
So it happens where, you know, Joe Wood like appears at noon and like people start to talk about it. And then JFK Jr. dominates the headlines for 2 weeks straight.
Right.
And he got buried. And, you know, there's something about that really bothered me. Cause it's not the press coverage part really, but what bothered me was they had spent a tremendous amount of money in a short period of time looking for him. And I felt like if he had gotten media coverage, particularly him being an Eagle Scout. So Eagle Scouts don't walk into the woods and just vanish. I mean, it could happen, but where is his day pack? Where are his binoculars? Where is the stuff that he took with him that other hikers saw him with? Like, where did those things go?
Right.
That he didn't leave like a trace. And I felt like those pieces of the puzzle in a national news media environment would have brought searchers out. And that, like, that element of it is what drove me to start looking at those particular cases. Now, with True Crime Excess, I've gone much further than that. And that was just sort of the ignition point for me. Like, I knew how to go through newspaper archives and court archives and all of those things along the way. But people like him that leave no trace were the, I would say there's like 30 cases where people vanish in a period of time and in such a way so quickly. Although his wasn't reported right away, there were other people around him that should have seen him, like other hikers. And like, they came forward and said, we saw him doing this. But I wanted to know why there were no found objects after the fact. And I came to the belief that that is one of the ways that I could identify certain cases where most likely someone like Israel Keyes was involved. And he actually, Israel Keyes himself is sort of an anomaly, because it's very rare that we get, you know, multiple hours of a serial killer talking, released to the public. And the Alaskan news agencies, and there's a book, American Predator, the publisher behind that, and the author, Maureen Callahan, they were very instrumental in making sure that the FBI released information about this killer. So when I started connecting dots on certain disappearances, I went, you know, at first I went to like the reading that was available, which Maureen Callahan's book is more recent. I mentioned her because she was in this like multi-year fight to get some of the information. And she and I don't come to the same conclusions on certain things, but we both had the same question. And that was, how is this guy that, you know, ends up on locked down on this one homicide for sure. He you know, abducted, assaulted and murdered Samantha Koenig in Alaska, and then he got caught with her ATM card and he confessed. Mm. How is this guy a serial killer and they've never found another body?
Mm.
And that question, linked with my obsession with people who had mysteriously vanished, sparked a couple of conversations. And one of those conversations was with the members of the team that's behind True Crime XS. Sorry.
No.
I don't know if you might want to.
So this guy, Israel Keyes, he, you know, they did label him a serial killer. I mean, that was a very curious.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Even he, now.
So they have him down for 11 to 13 bodies.
Okay.
And they, so he confessed to one outright. That was the Samantha Koenig murder.
Okay.
And then in the course of that, he was sort of jockeying for, you know, preferential treatment and to like show how serious he was. He gave them two bodies of a Vermont couple named Bill and Lorraine Currier, who are still considered missing people. He gave a detailed enough description confession. He provided them with the location of a small caliber handgun that was in their nightstand, registered to them, registered to the wife. And he told them what he did with these bodies. And the FBI spent a lot of money. They spent over $1 million looking for them, and they couldn't find them. And then in the course of his time, he was incarcerated from March of 2012. He got picked up in Lufkin, Texas, and taken to Anchorage for the Samantha Koenig murder. And he was incarcerated till December of 2012, and he killed himself while he was in jail. And they interviewed him, you know, dozens of times in there. And he confessed to Samantha Koenig. He confessed to the murder of the Couriers. But the other things that he confessed to are so vague that it's difficult to discern who the victims were. And he was adamant that until they gave him an execution date, that's what he wanted. He wanted the death penalty. And he said he'd tell them everything. And they could not figure out. The U.S. Attorney's Office got involved, and they were acting as officers of the court. They were trying to be realistic about the timeline for an execution in the federal system, which at that point in time, we were not really executing anyone. Like, Timothy McVeigh was sort of the exception to that rule. And if you look at some of the decisions made in the 60s, those were still having a heavy influence on capital punishment in the federal system. So this guy wanted the death penalty and really couldn't get it in the time he felt would be appropriate. He had originally said he wanted to be executed within a year. and he was willing to play ball if they would just set a date, like even if it was 36 months from now or 24 months from now or whatever. And his attorney that was appointed to him, because he had no assets at the time of his arrest, was anti-death penalty and spent a lot of time fighting. It's an incredibly complicated legal situation to sort of shuffle through. But ultimately, he decided he didn't want to play anymore. And he took his ball and went home by killing himself.
Right.
It's horrible because there's a, you know, the FBI says 11 to 13 people. I have him pegged for around 80.
Wow, that many.
Yep.
Now,
and he describes them. He describes the murders. If you listen to him talk long enough, he describes different murders in different ways. And, you know, when a killer says certain things, you can tell, like, if it's their first time. And this was not his first time. This was not his fifth time. This was dozens and dozens of times that he knew what to do in a murder situation. And the biggest thing for us was we wanted to start finding the bodies. And that is, so on July 3rd this year, we're releasing our finale episode. We think we've determined, based on his words, based on the FBI records that I was able to procure, and based on all of the interviews that we've listened to, the interviews that we've read related to his family and friends, we think we've determined where he was putting the bodies. And it's a shocking thing. It's a big reveal. So sorry to be vague about it, but like, it's one of these things that at first we were pretty sure it was just him. And now we think there were other killers doing the same thing he was doing. And it's not unheard of in the world. It's unheard of in North America. And I think it's going to be a shocking thing for people to realize.
Wow. Wow. And so you think he did that, the guy from New York? Name again?
Joe Wood. We think he was Joe Wood. So we went by proximity there. That vanishing, no found objects. It happened at Mount Rainier in Washington. And at that point in time, Keyes was stationed at Fort Lewis in Washington State.
Okay.
And he was in the shape of his life. This guy was like, so I don't know how familiar you are with Army, but so this guy was a Ranger qualified infantryman.
Okay.
Now, he didn't do a lot with that, but he was assigned to the 2-5 infantry, the 25th infantry. And he was currently, at that time, from 99 to 2001, he spent time at Fort Hood. We think he went to Fort Sill. We know he went to Benning. But he was part of an OSINT unit that mainly stayed at Fort Lewis. So he was in the shape of his life. He within a couple years of that, he was running marathons in fairly good times. Like, he was running marathons in the 3.5 to 4 hour range, like, without really training. And that's sort of unheard of. Like, elite runners, they do it in much less time than that. But somebody that just run off the street and run a marathon, that's a good time to run a 3:45 marathon or whatever he was running. But he was mountain climbing, he was camping, fishing, hunting, spending a lot of time in remote locations. And I definitely think that he is a strong possibility for Joe Wood. And once the body location reveal happens, I think that searchers will potentially be able to find Mr. Wood.
Now, the FBI knows where these bodies are. Did I hear that right? Or you all think that you know?
We think we know. The FBI does not. Okay. The FBI can, okay, so they consider this case closed.
Mm-hmm.
They decided it was going to be too expensive. There was no court date in the future where they were going to have to, you know, actually, like, take anybody through a process. Once he was dead, they put out an all call and, like, several requests for public assistance, but they didn't look very hard. And I'm not saying that they didn't spend some time and energy on it. I'm saying that, like, their ultimate goal was to sort of wrap up how many bodies he had, but they got a bow put on that within a year and told by their bosses to stop looking.
Okay.
And he told them in the interviews, they just weren't listening to him.
Now, you have all the interviews and all that. Is that online, or you guys had to do special FOI requests to get it, or?
We originally were part of the FOIA request to get them, but they are now online. Like over the past 3 years, the interviews have now been put online where you can listen and see some of them. Some of them are video and some of them are just audio.
Okay. Wow, that's interesting stuff. It sounds like this whole true crime thing was in your blood, as you talked about your mom and your dad there. How about the rest of, now you're a team of four. How about the rest of the team? How did they get into true crime?
Well, so the team, all right, most of them remain pretty anonymous on purpose. They work primarily missing persons cases. I will say one is like a stay-at-home mom, and that just became her thing, actually right as she became a mom. One of them has like three jobs, and this is the thing that they do for free. Like they provide resources and they're just a really good fact finder and research person. And the other one, I don't know what their ties to true crime were, but there's a fifth member that is mainly military, and he works very public facing. So we don't identify him by name, but I will say this, he's a lobbyist with a lot of press contacts. And he's got contacts with several agencies that I would not have been able to get on my own, where I can call and ask a question and say, hey, do you guys know about this thing? It could be like anything minuscule or major. And for the most part, they've been able to answer a lot of those questions, which is what has driven this investigation further. In fact, even if the interviews had not been released online through his contacts, we likely would have gotten most of them.
Okay. Wow. Now, what's the reason that they want to stay anonymous? Are they fear?
They work on cases where one of the people involved, one of their big cases was Scott Peterson, which was that's many years ago. It's not that they want to stay anonymous because they just feel like that's the way to go. In fact, like, you know, me using my name is a huge deal to them, and like I get some flack for it. But with these guys, what they discovered along the way was there are people out there on both sides of the more public and polarizing cases who their whole thing will become outing you and trying to tear your opinions apart. And we weren't worried about, like, nobody was really worried about getting hurt feelings, but it became an issue with us being able to make any progress. And like, for example, there's a case in Ohio, the Brian Schaefer disappearance, and we worked on that for a very long time, and we never were able to come to a conclusion because you don't answer all of the questions and you don't solve all the cases that you set out to. And some of the opinions that we had put forth, even from an anonymous perspective, just to get people to provide some more information, we got attacked on. All of us did. And there was another case down in Texas where this guy had made a mysterious 911 call. And, you know, I went out to the site and like looked to see where he had disappeared from. And that was in 2013, I believe. This guy, he had a lot of issues in his life, but he had vanished in a way that didn't make a lot of sense. And when I physically went on site down there, I got a lot of flack from the neighbors of the area he went missing in. And there was a lot of private property involved. And I had just been basically asking, hey, do you mind if I poke around? Because I thought the guy had walked into the brush on the side of the road and probably just gotten into an area he couldn't get out of. Or when I got down there, I realized he might have got bit by a rattlesnake. So that time it was in August. And, we get a lot of good feedback sometimes, but a lot of times it starts to impede the progress. So they've decided, like on cases like Maura Murray or Breonna Maitland, if we work those cases, we don't really talk about it unless we're actually asking questions. And then just one of us goes and does the legwork and like the FaceTime.
Now, is it the family? Is it the people who live there who just don't want you stirring up trouble, stirring up business? I mean, I guess I'm a little confused as to.
Well, it used to be. Now it's the internet.
Okay.
Like when people, like there are people, like for a lot of, like missing Maura Murray, is a podcast, and they've spawned other podcasts around it. It's not them directly, but there were people in that area that didn't want to talk to us and didn't want us bringing it up again. Not from the perspective of like we did something, we're hiding something. From the perspective of every time somebody comes here looking, shit gets stirred up, and like bad things happen.
Mm.
And that's more the perspective. Like, so the progress becomes, you don't know if you're getting real answers. Some people don't want to give answers. And, you know, when you're working on something with like the Israel Keyes case, for instance, like a lot of people don't want their name attached to that. Like that you've got some crazy idea. You're chasing some serial killer. You're looking down this rabbit hole that is his life. And we don't really want to be affiliated with that. And the other problem was the biggest problem was there's so many jurisdictions. This takes place in 15 states. And, you know, we have 30 national parks and 15 national forests, 16 state campgrounds, and, you know, 16 other locations that were sort of private or adjacent, like cemeteries and things like that, that we're looking in. And you can't find a good, you know, it's not like you have to find one liaison. You have to find like 30.
Mm.
And that's just hard to coordinate. It's hard to coordinate. And I think that's ultimately, you know, that's why the FBI would have been super helpful with all of this. But I think they sort of washed their hands of him. And he's become one of the biggest things for me in, I'm trying to take away the mythology of him. Like, I mean, he is a monster, but like he's a reasonable monster, not a Bigfoot or, you know, like there's nothing magical or paranormal about him. So like, let's close the book on this guy once and for all and find a bunch of these bodies and sort of slam the door on it and be done with that dude, which is unfortunate because the first thing you have to do is point out what he was doing. And then, in another world, I probably shouldn't have made a podcast out of this. I probably should have just gone around to each location. But we realized early on it was going to be really complicated because of, you know, the common location is what I'll call it for the sake of this podcast. And I will, like, if, you know, after the finale, if you want to talk again about how crazy it is, I'm glad to do that.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah. I'm looking for, actually, you got me really intrigued. I'm definitely going to check. I did check out a couple episodes. So I'm definitely digging what you guys are doing. Yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah.
And we've talked to all these, like more recently, I've talked to a lot of people who are in criminology and also in search and rescue, because I was like, hey, you guys are missing these three places, you know, when you search. And they just look at me like I've lost my damn mind. And I was trying to get like an expert on with search and rescue. And there's, you know, several people that have written books on like the mentality of people who are lost and like the best ways to search like remote areas. So I wanted like some of those people's feedback. In fact, some of their like research and their work is what led me down the path that I went down. And I would say like the final part of our puzzle is a geospatial equation, meaning geographically, if you were to run an algorithm of where people could be in an area, and you had looked in all those places, did they get taken from that area? Or are they still there and you just didn't look in the right place? And, you know, that's why I mentioned like the parks and forests and everything, because what we discovered was looking at other countries for search and rescue, specifically like South American countries and African countries. Search and rescue is a very different deal in the Sahara or in the jungle than it is in the US. And that's like sort of geographically and topographically true, but it's also true, like the mentality. The mentality in other places, and it expanded beyond, for the last couple of episodes of the podcast, it expanded beyond just search and rescue. The homicide detectives that I spoke with in other countries do different things. They look different places. They are very aware of like humans being the worst of the worst for 10 minutes of their life. And like they get very creative in that time. And here, I think they know it, And we sort of handed off to folks like the FBI. And ultimately, the people that were getting involved at the end of all of this is the National Park Service, because we discovered that the National Parks and Forest Service had their own criminal investigative bureau. And while we didn't get a lot of love from the FBI, we are hoping that what we're trying to do with the Parks and Forest people will have more of an impact, if that makes sense. Because we had to put... To give you like a really really big tease to all of this, we had to put together a team, and we had to examine a bunch of logistics and legal implications of recovering these bodies because of where they are. Like, it's like way beyond what a normal pathologist or medical examiner would ever do to get them. And it's out of laziness. The serial killer was lazy. And we were like, this is, when we saw it all at one time. And one of the partners was sitting in the room with me. She was sitting on the couch when I was going through. I had gotten all these maps for one of our cases. And like, I actually got my hands on all of the search and rescue maps with a GIS tag. So I was able to like look at the GPS tracks of the searchers, and they were real specific. And I started seeing the locations there, and I just looked at her and she said, I don't know what just happened, but you need to tell me that. And, I had gotten all these maps from another person. And the other person texted me around the same time. And I said, oh my God. And she came to the same conclusion I did. And I said it out loud in the room, and everybody just stopped. And for like 4 days, we weren't able to work.
Wow.
Because we were like, this is like the craziest thing I've ever heard. And then we realized on four occasions, maybe five, I'd have to check the fifth one, the killer actually told them this location. We were like, no way. And so we all, the fifth day, where two of us are scrambling through the interviews and re-listening and pulling out these lines to make sure. And sure enough, we connected things from different interviews, and he flat out says where he put them. And I was like, oh my God, this is something that changes true crime. And the other part that was weird was he says, I wasn't the only one who figured this out. And we realized we thought it meant one thing. Originally, we thought it meant that like he could go to where people camp and people like go on these beach camping trips and whatever, and he could kill people that way and no one really knew it. But what he really meant was where to put the bodies. And we almost immediately connected five or six other killers to the same locations. And we were like, this is going to be a mess. We knew it was going to be a big deal. And we were like, do we just flat out say it? Do we just call somebody and tell them? Because that's what I tried to do. It was like, I tried to call and like talk to the FBI and say, hey, I need to talk to somebody about this case. And what I got back was this, you know, polite response of that case is closed. And thank you for, you know, if you have something to say, just tell us. But the truth was like, if I say it out loud, it sounds crazy. But if I show you on a map and I show you, you know, 8 years of research is done, it's a little different. And, you know, you definitely have to listen to the interview parts of it. And that's why I've been using chunks of these interviews, because I feel like they're important so that you understand we didn't make this up. We got it from him and from the investigators in the room. So,
wow, that's really interesting. 8 years of research. Is that what you said? That's how long you guys been at this?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So eight years of research, that we knew it was him.
Okay.
And we didn't know where the bodies were until about a year ago we knew. And,
okay.
I would say the research goes beyond that by another 4 years, but we didn't know they were serial killings. When we first started looking at disappearances and vanishings, it was this off and on thing we did. We were like, where did those people go? And I would go, you know, to the last known location of certain people and look. I was just curious. I was like, if I'm standing here, because it's different. Like, you can look at it on a map, you can hear about it on a news report or a documentary, but if you go stand there and you look around, it's different.
Right.
And right. So, you know, people like Joe Wood and Amy Bechtel and this guy Brandon Lawson that was down in the Texas and Brian Schaefer, I went to those places and I was like, I don't know what happened to these people, but like, I'm getting a better idea standing here. And the main reason that I had gone out to the Texas location was because someone I worked with had found something on a satellite image that they were sharing with me. And they were like, can you please go look at this spot? Like, I can't unsee it now that I've seen it. If you will go look and just tell me, is that a person? So I went out there and I found the spot, but I couldn't get into it because, one, it was on private property. So I have a rule when it comes to, like, you know, Texas to begin with.
Yeah, you better with Texas, but, yeah.
but private property in Texas is not a place I want to be caught. So there was a fence, and I was like, all right, I'm going to, and I told her, I was like, I'm going to look for your spot, but I'm going to walk down the fence line, and, like, it buttressed up to this creek. And I was like, if I can access it from the creek, I will walk along to your spot, but I'm not spending any time there. And I was like, I don't know where I'm at. I've never been here before. And like, what I've seen, there's no one here. Because I had driven, like, 4 hours out of my way. Because I wasn't, you know, I'm not from Texas. I don't know much about it. And I had driven 4 hours out of my way. And it was actually kind of creepy because there was nothing where I went to. And there had been nothing for several hours. Like, I'd seen the occasional gas station, but, like, it was just big flat oil derricks and windmills. That was it. And so I got there, and the town that I was at was doing construction. So they had one whole side of the town blocked off. And I was like, I have no escape route if something happens while I'm down here. And I walked along, and it was so thick with cacti. It was around the same time of year the guy went missing. But like 5 years later, it was so thick with cacti that I couldn't quite get to this little, she had picked out this grove, and it was right in the middle of trees, and she had dissected the guy's 911 call geographically and said, if he's driving this direction, he's run out of gas, he's talking this woman on the 911 call, then, and the search area was south of there. And she was like, that makes no sense. So she had said, hey, he says I'm between two fields. And she's like, he knows there's a gas station up here. He knows this road. So why would he walk south? Why were they searching south? So we were like a mile north of their search area looking at the spot. And I heard a gunshot while I was out there. And I was like, I'm done. I don't know if that's not related to it. It was far enough away. I didn't feel like I was in danger. But I was like, I don't want to be out here and get caught. So I looked around for maybe 10, 15 minutes in that area. And I realized it was so thick that there was no way for me to safely do it. And I bailed. And I actually turned that information over to a private investigator who was looking into the case. And I said, look, you guys want to do something there. Here's what we're trying to figure out. And, you know, I gave them a rundown of everything we looked into related to that particular case. And, you know, the guy that I handed it to had worked on some of the other cases we worked on. He's well known. And so I trusted him, and I was like, you know, there was a ranger involved too, a Texas Ranger. And I was like, you guys go look. I can't physically get caught on, like, Texas property and get, you know, harm done to me by a landowner who's totally within their rights of doing it just because I'm poking around looking for some, what, you know, is probably like tennis shoes on a cell phone. And so I've done some, like, interesting things like that. I prefer the remote areas where it's public land. Like, I don't mind looking on public land where it's like a Joe Wood case. That's Mount Rainier. It's a national forest. I don't mind doing that.
Right. Now, you're not scared? I mean, you're going to these locations where people end up missing. You're not scared of turning up missing yourself? Are you bringing protection with you or someone else? Or
I bring a dog with me. Okay. That's the biggest thing. I have a 100-pound Rottweiler. And okay. She goes everywhere with me. And I don't, you know, I'm not a believer in guns myself. Like the house is protected by one, and then I have, you know, bats and knives and things throughout the house that I would protect myself at home with. But when I go out in the woods, I have tools with me that would suffice. Like, typically, if I'm going to go, you know, poke around in a national forest and get a fire permit, like, there's a reason I have a small shovel and, like, a little mag light, and, you know, that's what I carry with me. I always have a knife on my hip, but I'm not scared of going missing myself. I tend to have enough people. Well, I take that back. I'm probably a little scared, but I over prepare who knows where I am and what my timeline is. Like, my partner and I, we're not married yet, so we just call each other partners, but we've been together for a really long time, and we timeline things down to the minute when it comes to stuff like this. Like she went with me to Texas, but like if I go to a national park or like a state park and I'm looking for like one of these locations, she knows how much battery life I have on the gear. Cause like one of the things we've had to use for this is a endoscope, like that people use to inspect homes.
Okay.
So it's a long snake camera. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's a tube that's about 12 feet long. Well, I only have so much battery life on those things. And she knows that if I'm planning on going out to do something like that, I'm going to time it down. I'm going to say, hey, I've got 2 hours of battery life. I've got my cell phone. I'm going to enter the park around this time and I'll come out at this time. If anything changes, I will call you with the changes along the way. So that's been our deal.
Right, right. Now, a lot of these are guys who are going missing, which is fairly rare. I mean, what's your theory about how a guy, you know, Israel Keys or whoever is doing this to other guys? I mean, is he catching them when they're sleeping? What do you have a theory about that?
So I think the best example, and like I hate to keep using Joe Wood, but I'm going to use him because he had binoculars. And he was looking for specific types of birds that he had outlined in this book he took with him, supposedly.
Okay.
He's holding these binoculars up for long periods of time and looking, you know, tree to tree, spot to spot. So I think that Keys was blitz attacking them while that was going on. And that is like temporarily disabling them and then strangling them.
Okay.
And then, you know, whatever the rest of his spiel was there. He's awful. I don't want to get into all the terrible things he did to people, but like he's a bad dude. So
So I mean, true crime. You know, as I mentioned this before in a previous episode, I mentioned again. You know, as a former officer, you know, sometimes we get off from work. We don't want to look into that kind of stuff. We kind of want to decompress and all that. And I remember one time I was reading it was a serial killer book. It was about serial killers who lived in England in the, around the time of Jack the Ripper. It detailed not only Jack the Ripper, but a number of other ones. Now, so I'm reading this book and I start getting nightmares. Does something like that ever happen to you where you're looking into all this kind of stuff and you start to get physiological reactions, nightmares or sweats or is it just so intriguing that you just love it too? I mean, so you don't have any of those type of problems.
Well, so, one of the people on the team I've known, it's almost 40 years now. She gets nightmares. Like our spouses hang out. I mean, our partners are, she's married with kids and they hang out together and she'll tell me sometimes, she's like, I'm not sleeping. She's like, I'm having dreams about this stuff.
Right.
And for me, I have some anxiety that comes from, what if I'm wrong? But the biggest thing for me is I have these dreams where it's crazy, but like, it's just me like standing in a forest and I can't find my way out. And I spend a lot of time putting myself in the head of, you know, if you're missing or whatever, what were you doing right beforehand? And like, what was that like? And I actually haven't had any dreams or anything about this killer, but I definitely, I've had a few moments where I don't have any good reason to, get the sweats. I say, standing in the woods, like I'll be standing somewhere and I get a bad feeling. And like, I know it's definitely a product of having, years and years and years of thinking about what would I do if, and like wondering like, is this that moment? Because the biggest thing I think this killer had going for him was the element of surprise. And, like you said, like were these people sleeping? I don't know what all of them were doing at the exact moment, but yeah, that's like a combination of things that it turns my gut a little bit, because those are moments where like you're actually enjoying, like to me, a big piece of serenity and peace.
Right. Exactly.
Like you're enjoying nature. And usually people go there either because they're used to it and it's part of their lifestyle, or because it's a big break from their lifestyle so that they can sort of regroup. And I do not have that ability anymore. The ability to regroup in the wilderness is gone. Like I would, you know, it's anxiety producing now. It's not the same.
I can imagine. And especially, like you said, you were a Boy Scout, so growing up in the woods or being familiar with it, and to be robbed of that because these maniacs are out here running around doing whatever, you know, blitz attacking people or whatever they're doing, you know, it's really, 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 really tragic. I watch the one of the shows that I do enjoy, well, I mean, as much as you can, is Forensic Files, as far as true crime, you know, TV shows anyway. And you know, a lot of times you see that people, a lot of times are women who are being attacked in the woods as they're jogging through a nice serene park. So I can imagine, you know, your anxiety and all that has been stripped of you. And I can't imagine doing this kind of stuff. And I from watching that show, listening to us converse, you know, I can imagine that people would be very apprehensive about going to the woods alone, whether you're going camping or bird watching or hiking. Would you have, I know that you're no expert, you did talk to some experts as far as recovery experts and all that kind of stuff. What advice would you give to someone who wants to go hiking in the woods or bird watching or mountain climbing, whatever?
Oh, I would say, you know, having some self-defense knowledge and some situational awareness are probably the two most important factors. But the other thing is having some kind of confidant who is going to check on you at certain times. And, you know, you kind of got to let it go. Like if you have a trusted person or two that you're checking in and out with in these places, and, you know, you pay attention and you don't, I honestly think that people just have to stick to the buddy system. That is the craziest thing to me. But, like, you know, you don't have to be sitting side by side. But if you're going to go hiking, take a friend. If you guys split off on a trail, just know where each other are.
Yeah.
You know, use communication devices as much as you can. Realize you can't rely on those. And, like, one of the things I just realized, like, I should probably tell this part, it fits. I do carry a flare with me. I carry a flare that I have yet to use, but, you know, I've had to switch it out a couple times because they expire. But my thinking there was I could always start a fire with it. And, like, worst case scenario, I could maybe make enough smoke in a quick amount of time without damaging anything that people could find me if I were really to be lost. As far as like the other anxiety provoking situations where if someone were to grab me, I don't know what would happen. I would probably be, if somebody blitz attacked me or rabbit punched me, I'd probably be gone. I'd probably be out for the count. There's nothing I can do about that. So, you know, I don't want to, like, make people paranoid either. I think that it's getting harder to do this. And I think that's one of the cool parts about this finale is, like, I think there's going to be a lot of cops in the woods for a while.
Okay.
It's going to change. It's going to change not just this killer's 80 cases or whatever. It's going to change like a couple hundred other cases for the considerable future. It'll give some people something to think about.
So your finale is in July, you said, right?
Yeah. July 3rd is the finale. It's actually right after the anniversary of one of the cases that we think is related to all of this, or at the very least, it's the case that inspired us to realize what was going on.
And so what's next after July for True Crime? Are you just going to call it quits as a podcast, or are you going to move on to something else?
So we will be, depending on the current situation, because ironically, one of the things I can still do is look for bodies. Because you can go out to national parks. You just can't interact with people, but they haven't closed the parks. So we will be spending part of our summer doing that. We're ramping up our gear so that we can do a little looking, but we've been treading lightly recently because we're trying to figure out the legalities of it. But after that part, and we will report in, it'll be much briefer than this particular season. But the next killer I'm going after is a guy named Neil Falls. And then I'm going after Scott Kimball. They're both serial killers. Neil Falls was actually killed by his last victim. Scott Kimball is in jail. And I think I know where some of their bodies are buried too. So they are probably going to be season 2 and season 3 of True Crime XS.
Very nice. Now, how long are the seasons? How many episodes, roughly?
The seasons run between 20 and 25 episodes. It depends on the post-production part, but we've been getting enough material for between 20 and 25 episodes.
Very nice. Now, where can we find your podcast at?
You can find us on Anchor, Spotify, Apple, pretty much anywhere you get a podcast, you can find us. Just look for True Crime XS or go to our website, truecrimexs.com, and just click one of those links there.
Very nice. And I got to say, I have been checking out a couple episodes. Like I said, I got to be sporadic with it because I do get nightmares. But I have enjoyed what you guys are doing, and I think you guys are doing a good job. And I hope that you guys can continue on. And I say that, you know, reluctantly. Obviously, you know, you need material. And unfortunately, there's sick people out here who are creating enough material for all these true crime podcasts. But I wish you guys the best of success and luck in the future. And I hope that everything, that all of your theories pan out as far as getting the closure for families. I know that people are still looking for their lost loved ones. So I hope that
I appreciate everything you're saying.
Yeah, I hope we can get some closed doors on that. I thank you thank you so much for being on the show, John Jennings. Thank you so much from True Crime XS. I really appreciate the conversation.
Have a great one, man.
Yeah, you too. Take care.